Hello, you're listening to Laser Graves, a podcast where we dig up movies, music, books, and events from the 80s and discuss how rad they were.
Dave Coulier cut it out.
As in, I'll probably cut it out.
Nope. Leave the whole wild pig story. This will be the wild pig episode. Did we even introduce ourselves before I started talking about a wild pig?
Hey, how's it going? Welcome to Laser Graves. I'm your co-host, E.K. Wimmer, and next to me is the Lord of the Dogs.
Yes, Lord of the Dogs, Mariah Rose Wimmer.
And welcome back to another episode. This week we are discussing a book from the 1980s, a book that we have not read before. We just found it in a thrift store.
Well, we read it before we started recording this podcast.
Well, yeah, as in like prior to. This is actually the first episode that we don't have any prior knowledge of the information.
Yeah, I'd never even heard of the author.
No, at all. And it was, it had a really cool cover, and I was like, hey, this was put out in the 80s. Let's try it out. Oh, come on. As far
I'm
as
pulling
covers
up,
go, that's
I'm pulling the book
cool.
up in front of my face right now and checking out the cover.
Okay, everybody needs a critic.
No, I'm not critiquing. I agree. I think it's cool.
It's a cool cover. It drew me in, and the name's really cool. I Vampire. And I thought, well, let's see. And it was written in the 80s, so why not give it a shot? So we both have worked through it and did not know what we were in store for, but
no,
wow,
no, we could never have guessed.
Special today. Before we get started, I'd like to thank everybody who has been liking and rating and reviewing, subscribing, uh-huh, sending us kind messages and gift baskets, fruit baskets, balloons, people in costumes at our
flowers.
Door singing. Yeah, it's been great.
Fresh houseplants.
It's been overwhelming.
We like more houseplants.
No, you would like more houseplants.
Thank you.
And anyway, it's been great. Also, I've been meaning to do this, but I was kind of waiting until we were a few episodes in so that we had some listeners, because I didn't want to waste it. But I did want to give a mutual shout out to some friends of ours over at Reconcinimation who have been running a podcast. John and David started this up earlier in the year. Well, I mean, I guess now
it was like in the summer, right?
Yeah, I guess now it's almost, it was last year, but it feels still pretty early. Mm-hmm. There are quite a few episodes in now. And I also would like to say that at that time, they contacted me to compose the opening theme for the podcast, which is 70s, 80s, 90s based on movies that they've seen. And they kind of analyze them and see if they hold up over time. Mm. It's really fun. I did the theme for it, and then I did another theme because I do a little segment, mm-hmm, every episode called Kurt's Corner, where they analyze if Kurt Russell was in it, if he was, like, who had the best hair, should he have been in it. It's really amusing.
Well,
and it, you know,
he always should have been in it.
He should always, and he always has the best hair, so it's kind of one-sided.
Yep.
But as big Kurt Russell fans, it's very funny. And so I also did a theme for that segment on Kurt's Corner, which is a throwback, like an homage to the Porkchop Express from Big Trouble in Little China.
Mm-hmm.
But that really, why I wanted to mention this is not only just to say go check them out, but also we had been discussing doing a podcast for a long time. And that's really what pushed me.
Yeah.
More towards like, well, we should do it, because I was having so much fun listening to theirs, and I realized like we need to really just get to it. And so kind of thanks for that extra little push. So check them out, Reconcinimation. They're on everything, you know, all the major social network sites, but really fun to go back through. The one that got me in, I think, was their like maybe first official one, but it was maybe their second, on Escape from New York, and I was instantly hooked. So it's
very nice.
It's a fun one. So with that, I guess we should get into it. Is there anything else you wanted to mention?
I don't feel like I should. I feel like you're shaking your head. Well, don't you dare.
Leave because that as a special memory so between us.
So much. He doesn't, yeah. I've got lots of stories, guys.
I got stories, man. I got stories. Yeah. But we've got to get to this book because there is a lot to process. I will say it was not as easy to get through as a Christopher Pike or an R.L. Stein.
No, I would fully agree with that. I thought it was going to be like a swift, easy read. And it is. I mean, it's a fairly short book.
It's only like 200 pages, but boy, those woods are thick that you're hiking through.
Yeah, it's not dense like Dostoevsky dense, but...
It's dense like beat poet kind of dense. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, because that's who she was hanging out with.
Yeah, you know what? I would say when I started this book, I don't know. I feel like there's a point where I go, am I in over my head? Am I missing all the references? And then you kind of calm down and you're like, oh, okay, well, I'll just read this book and move on with my life. But there's this moment of panic where you're like, should I know a little bit more about Ezra Pound before I dive in deeper or something like that? But once you get past that point, it's pretty fun and easy read.
It is fun. I had
also
no clue what I was in for, but
no,
it's the type of writing I really enjoy.
You're an E.E. Cummings fan, so
yeah,
on
that Burroughs kind
friend.
Of style too. That just really weird kind of beatnik surrealist writing that's all nonsensical, but it seems like it until you realize, like, oh, once you get
there's a bigger message.
Yeah, and once you get their kind of cadence and their style, you're like, oh, okay, I see what they're saying.
Yeah,
and you can start to follow it all, but at first, it is a bit overwhelming. There was part of me that was like, this book is one of two things. It's either like total BS and a total nightmare, or it's a little over my head and I'm not quite getting it. And then by the middle of the book, I was like, oh, okay, I get where she's going. And
you just
got to
fall in step with her.
And it's definitely, I mean, she's an award-winning, very established, very adored. I don't know, awards, awards I don't know of. But she's just this kind of cult figure. And so she was a very intelligent and sharp writer, especially for her time. This is actually the second in a series.
Of three,
yeah. The first was called, what was it called? It had a really, Passing for Human. Yeah, Passing for Human, that's what it was called.
Was that it?
And that came out in the 70s. And then I, Vampire came out in 1984. Jodi Scott is the author, and that's what we're going to be discussing today. But I was nervous, like, getting into it, and then halfway through, I was like, oh, I wonder what you'll think of it. And then I have been anticipating this podcast episode in particular, because normally we approach it already knowing the other's opinion on the subject.
Yeah.
This one was blind.
We haven't talked about it either.
At all. It's been like a kind of gag order on both of us. Like, let's just keep it for tonight.
That's a weird thing about this podcast, because normally we have sort of an open dialogue nonstop at all times through talk or text. And so I was reading this and you even had to ask if I'd finished it because we've been so quiet.
Yeah, we just have been totally out of touch with each other on it. Yes. Yeah. Before we get into the book, I wanted to give you a little background on Jodi Scott because I Googled her and it's like impossible to find anything. I mean, it's really, she is very reclusive or was, and just was impossible to find any real content until I finally hit one like goldmine nugget of a former friend who said, you know, I've been reading these things. It was after her death. So she was born in 1923, but died in 2007.
Wow.
Yeah. And
that's really interesting to think of her age as we continue forward. Like maybe keep it in your mind that she would have been in her 60s.
Yeah.
When she wrote
was
this.
Part of these movements that were happening as they were happening. You
okay.
know? She was like in the forefront of that. And so this friend was reminiscing and saying, and I'm reading these things about her, but nobody actually knew. Or is it saying anything of substance?
But does anybody know anybody?
Well, and she admits that. She says, you know, I only know a little, but it was very revealing and gave way more than... The only other thing I could find on her was a brief biography on the website for her, which was, I think she wrote, and it's very sarcastic and dry, like her style of writing. Yeah, you should read it. But what I did find out about her is this. So I think she was born in Chicago, actually. She went to college, dropped out of college because, shocker, after reading this book, she thought basically everybody was stupid and she was too smart to be able to deal with all this nonsense. And she had a very, very healthy ego. We'll say that. That was, from by all accounts, self-proclaimed genius, and everybody else was stupid. And
that's all you need to be.
That's what gets you where you need to be.
My mother told me I'm a genius.
Yeah.
I believe it.
Yeah.
For sure.
And that's what, I mean, I think that's a driving force in a lot of people, although it can rub some people the wrong way. But this person happened to be charmed by it.
Her friend was?
Yeah. She was married a few times. Where she really got her start was in the 1950s, writing gay mystery pulps under a pseudonym of Thurston Scott. And I think she collaborated with another guy doing that. But she was writing these pulp novels.
Was she married to Thurston Scott?
I don't know. I think she was.
Okay.
I could be wrong. I mean, totally like loose on these facts. But she was married a few times. And they were just kind of like...
gay.
Yeah, like stand-in marriages because she hadn't come out. And so...
Oh, she's gay. Well, I didn't know if she was a... I mean, we'll see.
You read this book, right?
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that she's gay.
Yeah, she was. But she had several marriages,
too.
And then in the, like, 60s and stuff, she ran a really successful or mildly successful bookstore and coffee shop in Berkeley, and that became the like hub for all these beat poets and surrealist poets and stuff. Yeah, people like big ones like Henry Miller. I always say this name wrong, but Anais Nin.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
That's what it had.
Anais, yeah.
Yeah. Those kind of people. Like, they were frequents there and would come swing by. So she was in the thick of it and was writing these weird short stories and pulp novels and stuff like that, sci-fi. And then she fell on hard times. Her story gets way more bizarre. She, to make ends meet, started working for this, like, porno company.
What?
And then that company went under, and the guy just gave her all the equipment. So she
Wait,
was
what
like,
was she doing for the company?
Who knows?
Was she acting?
No,
was she
I think
producing?
She was, like, just helping, like, run it. And so he gave her all the equipment, and she just kept it going and made a lot of money in the 70s producing, like, X-rated films
What?
To pay the bills. Yeah. And then after that, she sold, you'll like this because of the book, she sold encyclopedias door to door and was very successful, I guess, at that. And then moved, ultimately, she moved to Shoreline, Washington, where our friend lives, and had a house and lived there for the rest of her life. And the friend who wrote about her basically said she sold real estate, but was kind of a scheme artist about...
Scheme artist? Is that different than a scam artist?
Well, she was scheming, but there was an art to the scheming side, color scheme artist.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't really a scam, but...
kind of was.
So she was there...
Is a scheme like a gentle scam?
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
Oh, soft
picking
scammy.
Up on what I'm saying. And
I'm smelling what you're stepping in.
Oh, yeah. A big old pile. and then, you know, the end of her life, she lived with this woman. I think her name was Mary for a long time and then died. But she was super reclusive, very difficult to be around. A lot of people didn't, you know, kind of see her. But the general feeling was, yeah, a very healthy ego. But she has this status. People like Neil Gaiman and stuff, like, really dig her work. I mean, so she's just this unknown figure that I'd never heard of. Joanne Margaret Hugolette was what her actual name was, but she went by Jodi Scott. And the only, like, description of her character beyond the ego and stuff was this friend wrote, quote, she was a butch babe who looked good in a tuxedo. I liked
nice.
That. I thought that was pretty fun.
All right.
Anyway, so that's the background on Jodi Scott.
All right.
And I thought that was helpful because normally when we're discussing things, people already have a pretty good understanding. Like,
yeah.
We didn't have to discuss Alice Cooper's background last episode, but this is I'd say this is probably the most obscure thing we've done so far. So far,
yeah.
Yeah,
she's
sticking with us.
She's fascinating already, but I mean, as we dive into the book, and we're going to have to kind of power through.
I don't want to make this two episodes.
And there's so much that happens here. I think we'll have to just like set a quick clip.
Let's get into it, man. Buckle your seatbelt. Your hyperdrive, because we're going plaid.
Oh.
Spaceballs
nice.
Okay. Do you want me to lead the charge and you just chime in since I have way more notes than we can get through?
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll see. Let's see how this goes.
All right. So I, Vampire, 1984 by Jody Scott. Mm-hmm. It opens up 700 years in the past. With
1280s.
With a teenager banished for sucking the blood of a priest. And her name is Sterling Oblivion. That's our character.
Apostrophe Oblivion.
Mm-hmm. That's our main character.
So she's Romanian.
Transylvanian.
Yes.
I think, yeah. And then we immediately flash in time to the 1980s, I guess, present time.
She's kicked out of her house in the 1280s and for being a vampire, and then suddenly we are in present day 1980s.
Yes.
Where she's running a dance studio.
Yes, she
obviously. I see the connection.
Absolutely. She works for a dance studio in Chicago. She lives in a posh hotel. She is very...
Does she own the hotel?
No, I think she just lives in it.
Okay.
But she's very upper class. Kind of reminded me of that Hunger style of... You know, remember in The Hunger, how they all live this kind of upper class like.
Well,
lifestyle.
She's had like 700 years to build a like financial portfolio, so she should be okay.
She's very sarcastic and skeptical of people. She thinks that they're all kind of stupid, and
I mean,
can you blame her? And that's who our main character is, Sterling Oblivion. So that's where we're at. We find out she has this assistant slash lover named Johnny File.
Did we say it's a dance studio that she runs?
Yeah, it's a dance studio.
In
like
Chicago.
A really high-end dance studio where like really, really wealthy people pay for dance lessons.
It's called the Max Arkoff Studio.
Right, and he's like a famous dancer. That's the boss.
It's like a Fred Astaire character.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get a new hire named Patsy Cox who comes in and she's going to like work out. But they have
Patsy Cox, really.
They have tension right away. And then we find out right away, too, she's... also building a time machine.
She calls it her TTM, her time travel machine. So she's a time traveling vampire who is the manager of a dance studio. And this is where we kind of learn about how the dance studio is run. They get teachers like come in because they want to work there. And she gets them like in debt.
Mm-hmm.
By like giving them makeovers and then taking out a line of credit in their name where they get a bunch of fancy clothes and then they're kind of forced to work almost as slaves for the studio.
Yeah, it's like a
it's just like a scheme, like a pyramid scheme kind of situation.
What was the term I used in the intro?
I don't
earlier.
Remember.
Fancy wasn't a scheme.
Yeah, you said
scam.
Scheme instead of scam.
Right. Okay.
Well, it's both a scheme and a scam.
There you go.
She's scheming and scamming in the 1980s. Her assistant, Johnny File, I'm not sure if he dances, but he's also a poet and he's her assistant and also her lover.
Yeah. And she also has very sarcastic comments about his poetry, which is really funny.
She's not impressed by his poetry because, as we learned, she keeps referencing like all the great authors of the world. And apparently she knows them all.
This is definitely a very pretentious book in a good way, though. It's fun, but it's like an intellectual reader's book. And you either get on it or you're like, whatever.
Okay.
So then flash forward to chapter 3. This is fun. We get a little vampire lore. We find out that she can be in the sun. She's telepathic, I guess.
Yes.
And also, this is my favorite part that I had not kind of seen in another vampire story. She only needs 6 ounces of blood a month to survive.
So she doesn't have to kill a person.
Right.
That's like half a pop can.
Well, and she says that there's no class in killing. Like, she's above that. She's really like a high class lady.
It sounds like she has not killed anybody up till that point.
Or like tries not to, basically.
Yeah.
And then also, I love the little note about that she reads vampire novels.
Yeah.
I thought, that's probably what I would do, too.
I would, too, just to see what people thought of me.
Yeah.
Maybe.
And then we get another little backstory that we find out her last husband was named Armand, and he is...
Armand von Salza.
And he was supposed to be kind of dead, was the impression, but he's back from...
Well, no, he's not dead. He's just very, very old, so she had presumed him dead.
Okay, but
he's
alive and well.
He's alive. He's well. He signed up for disco dancing
lessons.
A package of 10 prepaid.
And she has three kids also, we discover.
Two sons.
And then a daughter who she's estranged with, who is a vampire.
The daughter is a vampire and living in Saint-Tropez or something like that.
I don't remember. she rarely kills, like we said. So that's a little backstory on her, which is pretty interesting. It's very non-traditional as far as the vampire goes. It's kind of like...
It's no Anne Rice situation.
Yeah, it's like a whatever kind of thing. I just happen to be a vampire. Yep. She's really struggles with it too, about her human. She's a lot more sympathetic to humans though than most vampires are.
Yeah, she doesn't want to hurt anybody.
Yeah, I was just surprised by that.
But she's annoyed by them very sarcastically.
I also unless you have anything between now and then, but I want to skip to chapter 6 because she talks about. I love the idea of you're traveling. You're like you've been alive for 800 years or 700 years and. Mm-hmm. You've gathered things along the way, and there's this one line where she discusses her collection.
Oh, yeah.
I have it quoted down because it was so funny. The things that she has held on to over these years, she has a collection of, quote, 947 crucifixes, 442 mm-hmm. Stars of David, and a four-leaf clover in plastic that says, I found it at Tahoe.
Oh, these are all things that people had used to try and ward her off, I believe.
It's just so much fun. This book, the tone of this book and the style is so much fun to read.
It is.
It's a little much at times, but at the same time, considering normal books that we've been reading, I'm like, okay, this was kind of a welcomed break.
It's sort of like hopping into a Tom Robbins novel or
Cummings poetry book.
Also, it's at this point, chapter 6, that she looks out the window and sees her assistant, Johnny File, with Virginia Woolf.
Yeah, because she has a cool telescope, an old telescope that she can stare from her apartment into the dance studio. And I'm like, she seems so cool. She talks about, walking around either naked or in some cool robe and using this old telescope. She's very old world. But mm-hmm. living in a modern environment, I definitely could see this as a movie. It would be fun.
And then she actually talks about, okay, so it's the 1980s and her assistance with Virginia Woolf.
Yeah, just walking around the studio.
Who has clearly died via suicide many decades prior. But she has a flashback because she knew Virginia Woolf and she talks about her 1 hour with Virginia Woolf
in Paris when she was hoping to hook up with her basically.
Yeah. They'd had a weird walk through some sort of outdoor garden. Mm-hmm. Nothing happened, but they agreed to meet the next day. And when Sterling Oblivion came back, Virginia Woolf stood her up.
Yeah. It was a fun little flashback. Mm-hmm. And then from there, we get a weird...
Another flashback.
Another, a really far flashback of where she was almost tarred and hung. And
like in the 13th century.
Yeah, but she was saved by this duke, and she lived with him until he died, but he had the greatest library, and that's where she researched science and started developing this idea mm-hmm. of a time machine. I mean, this story... Part of me was
bananas.
Like, it's a hot mess. And then part of me was like, oh, no, this is really fun to read.
I would say it's not a hot mess.
No, not at all. Yeah, my final takeaway, and we'll talk about that at the end, was it's not. But at first, I was like, wait, you're already introducing 12 different novels. But somehow it works.
It's a lot. It's a whole lot. So then we go back. So we had a Virginia Woolf flashback, obs, and then a spying on Johnny File. We had the mob attack, and then we're back to spying on Johnny File with Virginia Woolf. And then she runs into this, 20th century or 1980s Virginia Woolf in the bathroom of the hotel, or is it the...
I think it's a dance studio.
Dance studio.
And there's a struggle.
They brawl.
Yeah,
they full out brawl. Yeah. Like vampire and 1980s Virginia Woolf. Full fight.
Yeah.
And who's the victor? They begin to communicate telepathically during the brawl.
And Virginia tells Oblivion, quote, Oblivion, your help is needed. And mm-hmm. we find out that Virginia is not Virginia.
No.
That she is, in fact, some alien life form. And she is giving a holy task to... Sterling mm-hmm. Oblivion to restore the order, restore the chaos, get rid of the chaos of the world, that humans have to become sane.
To evolve.
Yeah, before they can advance and expand out into the universe. Basically, All the other alien species are looking at Earth going, like, no, you guys are dumb, and we're not going to let you come out into here until you guys can prove that
they're either
not worth exterminating.
They're going to, they've kind of been given, well, Sterling's been given an ultimatum, like, either you evolve or you're going to be annihilated.
And she's coming to Sterling because she's a vampire, so she's one of the only people on Earth who has actually lived long enough to start to see things a little differently.
Yeah, because she sees like an immortal.
Yeah.
Or she's a human, but she thinks like an immortal.
So they think that she can assist with evolving the human species to become sane enough to,
yes,
to grow. Basically.
And we also learn Virginia Woolf's real name is Benaroya.
Mm-hmm. A sea pig.
She's a kind of described as like in her true form when she's not wearing like a Virginia Woolf body. We learn she's like a pink flabby dolphin from Vendera.
Yes.
The planet of Vendera?
No, she's from the planet of the R word, right? Rez?
Oh, maybe. I don't know.
Well, how do you say that? Rizimus?
No, the people are Rysimians.
Rysimian.
But they're from the planet of Vendera.
Oh, okay. There was a lot to take in, so.
You can see the confusion. Also, Virginia Woolf shows her the H2 unit,
right,
which is like a gun, like a laser gun. But
it's like a freeze gun, isn't it?
Yeah. She says this was Virginia Woolf, pig woman, was given immunity to it. This is really important. She says that she was given immunity from this particular unit, and she urges Sterling Oblivion to not try and use it on her, or she will destroy her own self. This is important because it comes in later.
I did not.
So,
that.
But the H2 unit freezes a person in their body.
So they can't get out of the body because the aliens can switch body forms.
Well, they say that basically every sentient being has the ability to like leave their body. But this H2 unit traps you in it forever. Yeah. So that's when you could die a real death, because if you're frozen with the H2 unit and then killed, then that's the end of you.
Yeah, so there's the backstory on who Virginia really is. She's an alien coming to kind of help out and try and advance
alien.
The human race.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm going to skip to chapter 10 because that's when we meet Scaulos. Oh, wait. S-C-A-U-L-Z-O. How would you say that?
Spell it again.
Scalzo. That's what I'm going to go with.
Sure.
From Sajorian.
He's
a Sajorian. That basically this species is like the bad, and they're doing like human trafficking and slave trading. Earthlings.
Yeah, they want to just kind of keep everything as it is. They're very focused on order, but no progress, really.
Yeah, and they like control like commercial advertising, and they mm-hmm. also control all of the nuclear weapons, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we've got a good versus evil scenario that's been designed. But it's kind of hard to trust who's good and who's bad at this
point. Yeah, it's true. And then we're introduced to this bad guy through a commercial. And at this point, Sterling, Oblivion, and Benaroya, Virginia Woolf, are drinking in a pub or somewhere like that. They get super wasted, and apparently this is when they fall in love.
Well, it's a weird scene, though, where Benaroya, like, kills a man on the street and stuffs him in a trash can.
Yeah.
And that's when Sterling is like, oh, shoot, this is like the real deal here.
Something's
And then
on.
She offers Sterling revenge. She says, mm-hmm. you know, you can take revenge for being cursed as a vampire and you can have this world. You just have to help me evolve it first.
Yeah, she's saying, I give you the world, revenge, and like love.
Yeah, and then they basically fall in love because she's in her Virginia Woolf form.
Mm-hmm.
And also, we didn't mention the leader of this whole group is in the body of General Patton.
Oh, yeah.
That's pretty funny.
Are they called? The
You keep saying it.
Rysimians.
Rysimians. I don't know why I can't say that. Anyway, so they fall in love. And then she takes her to her ship called the Vendera. Is that what you thought was the planet?
The planet. So it's
no,
the
it's
name
a
of
ship.
Their ship. Okay.
Yeah, no. So the
But it's at looks like a bowling alley.
But it's a diamond ship. No, yeah. It's not. Well, it's not just a bowling alley.
But
it's like
that's
an entire
like what it looks
floating
like.
existence because they wake up and they're in an entire like 80s hotel.
Well, she wakes up and she's hungover. Sterling is.
Yeah, but on the ship, they've recreated an entire like city scene in the 80s and they are in a hotel, but that's all on the ship.
Okay.
It's huge. It's like this massive ship that can recreate.
So it's a little confusing.
It's very confusing.
But Ben Arroyo, Virginia Woolf. Should we call her Ben Arroyo or should we call her Virginia Woolf?
It doesn't matter. I mean, I think it's interchangeable.
Anyway, she sees that Sterling's hungover and is going to repair her body. Right. So she gives her these golden cufflinks, which she like clicks together like Dorothy in the
Wizard of Oz.
Wizard of Oz. But then she goes into... Then she goes into Spock's body.
Yeah, the body of Spock, right?
While Sterling Oblivion's body is healing from its hangover, she hops into Spock's body.
And on the ship, we meet all these other characters. Like, one is her, who we think is Virginia's boyfriend, is like this fur-trading, rough-and-tumble guy.
He goes under, like, is that Jennison?
Yeah, Jennison. And he, like, punches her in the face so hard that it ruins the
Sterling.
Spock's body. Yeah. And then we also see Abe Lincoln, who...
He's wearing gold lamé.
He's in drag. Yeah.
I mean, but he's in the
so
Oval
much
Office.
Fun. Yeah. And we get a tour of the ship, and we find out there's, like, human manufacturing. And basically, they can create anybody they want and wear them.
They can just have any body. So basically, what they're saying is, like, setting up the whatever's inside of you that makes you you doesn't belong to a body and it can go into any body.
Right.
And
so
it sort of sets the foundation that Sterling Oblivion is kind of focused on her own body rather than willing to shoot out
and evolve.
Yeah.
And that keeps coming up again and again where Ben Arroyo is like, you're thinking too simply. Like, you need to think beyond all this. And then they travel into the future and Oblivion gets a letter from Armand saying that Johnny File is a European Secret Service and
Johnny File, her assistant.
Yeah, and,
and
so
Armand
is
her, Armand is her husband.
Most recent husband, yeah.
Yeah.
And Patsy is also Secret Service. So we're finding out that it's a little more complicated than we thought, but this is all taking place in the future.
Yes, and on Mount Olympia.
And we're trying to follow all this. Can I take a moment?
No, on the Olympic Mountain, in Washington.
Can I just try and set the tone, though, because I feel like for our listeners, we're making this seem very, like, straightforward, like a sci-fi novel.
It's pretty
crazy.
I'm going
to tell you one. I wrote down just a single line, and this is not an understatement. Every single line of the book reads like this, so it is not for the faint of heart. Here's just one line from this whole section that Ben Arroyo is just randomly talking to Oblivion. Here's just a one sentence. Horse turds, your skull is a necropolis. That's how the whole book reads like that. I mean, just like, what are
that's
we even
great.
Listening to? So anyway, that's kind of that whole section. And then we get into the first section where I felt like this was a really unnecessary chapter. I mean, it was
No. It was super necessary. Are you talking about
The sexy 12? Hike?
Yes. So let me cover this then. So, okay. Sexy hike, whatever.
What was it?
Well,
it was them going on a sexy hike.
So they're in the future. They're in the Olympic Mountains. They take a hike. So they're just kind of taking a break from all the alien stuff.
Right.
All the vampire
they're
stuff.
Yeah, they're in Washington, right? Yeah.
They go up into the mountains. They eat berries. They swim nude. They fall more deeply in love. And it's sort of like a sense you get this conversation going where you get a sense that they're falling in love not so much with the body because we see Sterling reflecting on how disgusted she is with who Ben Arroyo is,
like
the dolphin creature,
the weird sea,
and it's
creature.
More about falling in love with the spirit of a person.
Right.
So we get that, but then they also start to develop their business plan.
Sure. I mean, that is the most important part
really
of this
important.
Chapter. But the whole, like, getaway was a little
unnecessary. Well, they had to make some time to develop their relationship and also their business plan. And their business plan is important because it's going to help evolve the human race. We also, it's in the following chapter that we learn the Jennison, like, guy who busted up... Sterling's nose when she was in the body of Spock.
Yeah, the mountain man. His name's Omark.
Omark. And he's also a sister clone
right.
of Ben Arroyo.
Yes, that's okay. her sister clone. She's just wearing the body of a fur trapper from the
1800s. Yeah, a male fur trapper. And she, Omark, is offended by the, masculine stereotype that's been placed upon him while he's on this body.
Yes.
But this is also really important where we learn.
Do we still have listeners at this point?
I don't know.
Thanks for going along. Okay, anyway, let's keep going. I loved this
book.
Can you
imagine listening to this and going, what's
such a
happening?
Fun book. I really want to read the first one now.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay.
So their business plan is...
Oh, yeah. Oh, are you ready?
Let's dive
into this genius business plan.
So their business is called FMTC. I'm going to kind of combine a few chapters here for
time efficiency. Oh, no. Yeah, that's okay. We've got so much to get through.
It's called FMTC, Famous Men's Telegenesis Corporation. So basically the point of that is they're going to get famous men to donate their sperm, and then they're going to be door-to-door salesmen, sell the sperm of famous men to housewives, and then those housewives will pay a subscription fee to their sperm donor, and they'll have a baby with Elvis or whomever.
Mm-hmm.
And the sperm donor gets a huge paycheck and has no responsibility to care for or connect with
their
child.
They're just strictly a donor.
Yeah.
But the idea is that they're going to gather information on the human species by the people who are willing to do this. That housewives and stuff that are willing to do this is going to determine
where they're at.
Yeah, where they're at right now. And
sure.
It's the determining factor based on this is going to be a case study
mm-hmm.
and decide if they should just be eliminated right now, all of humankind, or if no, actually their heart's in the right place and they're ready to evolve and mm-hmm. they can. So that's their grand business plan. And then
it moves forward rather quickly.
Yeah, there's a couple people we need to mention.
Yes.
Vicky Bauer, who's this kind of out of work, overweight, down
a
in the dump.
A lot of emphasis is put on her figure.
Yeah. And she's a roommate of a stripper named Ronell, and she sees the ad, so she's going to respond to it.
An ad for FMTC.
Yeah, Oblivion and Virginia Woolf put out an ad to try and mm-hmm. get people to, recruit people to start up this business with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also meet Blake Reardon,
mm-hmm.
who's an unemployed engineer from Boeing, and
mm-hmm.
he sees the ad. So they all go to this meeting
They're all
spot.
Desperate for money.
Right.
And go.
They're going to come get training, everybody who's willing to come. And they all come to this training site, which did you see what they get for coming?
What?
Their perk. They can walk out at any moment, which a
yes.
lot of them do when they start to hear the
mm-hmm.
that it's a sperm bank kind of thing. But they, no matter what, get a free lunch, a beer, and a kazoo.
Oh, yeah, the kazoo. Oh, my gosh. So this is actually the point at which I fell in love with Ben Arroyo. So,
oh, yeah, she really shines in this whole chapter.
Basically from here forward.
Because she's all pretenses are down. She's just look.
She's a delight. Oh, and I would love to have her over for a dinner party and let her sell me whatever thing she wants to sell. Basically, so she brings all these people in and she's all of you people who are not ready to evolve will leave. The rest of you are going to sell sperm for me. And so all of these people are what? And they leave. And then the rest, everybody who's desperate for money just stays.
But not just because of money. What I do like about this whole section is not only the way in which
she
delivers
honest.
It, but they're she's disheveled and loosely put together, but somehow they can't take their eyes off of her because she's
magnetic.
So charming. And
yeah.
I love
just
that
like
idea
you,
that
Eric.
Oh, thanks. Anyway, so Vicky volunteers and so does Blake. Vicky wants to be the sperm collector, actually. She's let me step up.
Yeah, she's I'm getting in on the ground level. She and Blake, there's both a section where they're we're getting in on the ground level.
And they both get promoted pretty quickly,
Yeah, because they're go-getters. She wants to go get that sperm, and Blake's a good salesman.
He's going
to
be the salesman.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden where Sterling goes back 5 years in the past to get some alone time because she's freaking out
about... Was it in the past or the future?
No, it's in the past. Remember, she goes backwards.
No, because then she goes to the future and she writes Sterling a letter.
That's later.
Okay, whatever.
I think. I could be wrong.
I think you're wrong. She goes to the future and sees like all the great things, remember?
No. Okay. I'm going to explain that when we get here because I wrote that down. She goes 5 years in the past to get some alone time to just kind of reset herself.
Using her TTM.
Yep. And that's when she finds out Armand has been shot. And then Blake and the others head out in a limo and like in the future back to the future time. And they start selling designer babies. The first client's Elvis. And it's all going well. Then chapter 18 is really the big chapter where we get a letter to Benaroya from Sterling, mm-hmm. where she tells her there's a group called the Inner Core that is trying to kill her. They know about their plans in the future because she's in the past right now telling her, like, they know what we're going to be doing in the future. And that she also, Oblivion, killed Patsy and a salesman. But then she said, however, I traveled into the future now 200 years and saw the Golden Age and then came back.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So it was very complicated, but I was taking very detailed notes because it was hard to follow.
I was not. I was speed reading. But
it's a lot of jumping around with a time machine.
Yeah. So basically, she sees that humans can evolve.
And that chapter 18, I don't know what you thought about it, but I loved it. The whole chapter was just a letter to her. And
from
it was
Sterling
explaining
to
everything.
Virginia Woolf.
And there's this whole scene about her killing Patsy and stuffing her in the
And she
freezer.
Feels badly.
She feels very. And she killed a salesman, too. Mm-hmm. She feels very badly because it was like Patsy came in with a gun and was basically like raiding mm-hmm. her apartment and it just happened. And you just get this great sense of, can you hear that?
It's our cats running upstairs.
Oh, I thought it was the wind outside. It's just our chubby cats making thumping sounds. Okay, anyway. I just really liked this chapter a lot and I think it was mm-hmm. good. Unfortunately, it was followed up by a chapter that I found to be a little bizarre, but
so
informative.
Okay, so Vicky, who had been recruited to join this business scheme, she's the one who collects the sperm from famous men.
Yes.
She's made a ton of money. We find her in Miami, where she's collecting sperm from...
A football player.
She's not interested in football. It's a lot of stuff about her body image issues and her loneliness.
Kind of a sad character.
She is. And sadly, we don't get any resolution with her.
We do, because
we find out at the very, very end.
If she sells enough,
she gets rewarded with Marilyn Monroe's body,
which she thinks is a joke because mm-hmm. an alien told her that, but she doesn't realize that the alien's being
totally honest. So she goes, she collects sperm. We'll just kind of breeze past that.
Yeah, that was a little interesting.
Yep. But at the end of it, we learn that she's abducted by the Sorjorians. And as has been Blake Reardon,
they've both
the
been
top
kidnapped.
Salespeople, yep. have been kidnapped by the Sorjorians. We don't know where.
They're picking them off. And it's followed by another weird chapter that apart from that, them being kidnapped, there's this whole weird scene about her, Virginia getting on a motorcycle and avoiding some people.
I loved this scene.
And then she like falls and then falls in a
sewer. Hold on.
Ugh,
so
I
she's
didn't get any of this.
No, I this was my favorite chapter in the
You're
whole book.
No.
My very favorite chapter.
Okay. All right.
So
well,
we get
a sense of who
Benaroya is, and it's basically this whole chapter of her like being in a human body and what that experience is like and how limited we are as humans. So she talks about eating these candies and she's like, actually I prefer rabbit poop, but it's not acceptable for me to eat rabbit poop, so I'm going to shove these things in my mouth. And then she's like, I can't make that face because it will make people uncomfortable. And you kind of get a sense, you're like, yeah, I am. I'm like holding back all of my natural beliefs and feelings because they don't fit into this, like, little box that we've set forth as acceptable human behavior. So then she gets started. These dudes start following her.
Yeah, I couldn't tell if they were Sojourians or not.
They were just punks.
Like 80s punks.
And she's charmed by them. And she says, okay, so it's a bunch of thugs following her with like bad intentions.
Like street punks from the
80s. Yeah, and she says, hello, sweethearts. She yodeled, actually. Are you aware that your potential is greater than anyone ever realized and that I admire you all so much it hurts? I mean... It made my heart hurt. It was so beautiful.
Okay, I get why you like this chapter.
Okay, so, and then they're like, she realizes that they're put off by it. So she, like, lowers herself and is like, oh, they want me to be scared. They're all
holding. Oh, yeah, that was a really interesting.
They're all holding back their real feelings. So she pretends to be scared for them. And, I mean, it's weird, but it's also, like, you get a sense that she's exploring what it means to be human. And I really love this chapter because it's all this weird stuff about her, like, marveling at the human experience, but also at our simplicity. So.
Okay. It ends with her crashing a motorcycle into the sewer. Okay. And then we move on to a section on Omar and the others are coming up with this plan, and then a bunch of joggers are out walking, and we find out that they're actually like agent aliens, and they shoot Omar. This is a pretty big chapter where they shoot him, and he has to ditch the fur trapper body, but he has an extra one called Mary Worth. It's like a female body.
But she's got like facial scarring and is like missing teeth.
Head. Yeah,
but she's like rough physically around the edges. Fit and old. Yeah.
And he puts her on and heads to Buenos Aires to look for the enemy cell of the Sojourians. Like, they're basically looking for the kidnapped, like
for
Vicky,
Blake and Vicky.
Yeah, and others. And so he heads down there to look for them. And takes on the life as a homeless woman. And
oh my gosh, that's such a good chapter, too.
And then, we'll take a sidestep real quick with a chapter on Oblivion traveling back to the 13th century Transylvania just to eat an apple. And then...
I mean, wouldn't you, though? And how then, romantic is that? Like, you miss the 13th century apples, so you're going to go there... spy on your old life just a bit, eat an apple, and then come back.
Yeah, it's great. But then she has to come back really quick because Johnny File is there, and she knows he's an agent, and she's like, oh, you're here to get me. Uh-huh. But then, surprise, he is shot and killed. And so...
But she kind of believes that maybe he wasn't a bad guy all along.
Right,
it's
exactly.
Very clear.
There was a twist right there. Mm-hmm. And then that was a little, like, sidestep story. Chapter, but now we're on to like a full-on side story of Mary Worth.
So Mary being Omar, the sister
Jenison?
Clone. Yes, who is the sister clone of Ben Arroyo.
Who was the fur trapper, but is now wearing a woman's body.
Obviously.
Trying to break up, or trying to find the cell of aliens.
So she's like speaking Spanish, living in a homeless camp.
Yeah, and gets a really crude drinking buddy.
Whose name is Pepe.
Pepe. And they're like, she shows him that she can shoot guns and...
And repair cars. So she gets a day labor job with him.
Yes.
At what he's working at is like a homestead, but it's actually a Sojourian encampment where they have a poop ton of Chinese communists
as like prisoners,
neuroscientists and intellectuals held prisoner,
and they're feeding them human flesh.
Well, they're eating human flesh to survive.
And so she develops this plan, Mary, to help them escape, but they don't find the two missing salespeople.
They don't find Vicky.
She helps
repairs
them
a bus,
yeah.
Helps them escape.
But in the process, the body is ruined.
And he has to, like, shoot out, or Omar, he, she, whatever it is.
Goes back to the diamond ship and gets his old body back, the fur trapper body.
Oh,
and
yeah, gets...
He's pretty happy about that.
Yes.
And that's that. That was chapter 23. Mm-hmm. And then we go to a weird little quick story, which I actually, this is the only moment in the book that took me out of the book and put me into reality of who this was writing this book at the time in which she was writing.
Yeah.
There's this whole scene about Max Arkoff, who's the head of the dance studio. The, like,
yeah,
big,
so we're
famous...
back to the dance studio.
Yeah, and that's her boss. She's never really met him. He's a big deal, and he comes over to her house, and she's like, yes, this is crazy. She's about to bust out, like, fancy wine or champagne, and I thought at first he was, like, an alien, because she said he's acting really weird and out of character, And he fires her on the spot.
Uh-huh.
We later find out because she was openly gay.
Like he'd seen her kissing Virginia Woolf.
Yeah, and this was the only section that I was like, ooh, this is a pretty strong statement
in this
chapter.
Yeah, this book's very feminist.
And it's...
Extremely. There's a lot of, and we've kind of glossed over it, but there's a lot of feminism interwoven. It's also very... I don't know. It's a very forward-thinking book overall.
It's way ahead of its time. And this is when I was like, well, this is a gay woman writing a story about being gay and the problem. And then there's this little quick little, did you catch that one-off sentence where the assistant says, well, he's gay himself.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa, man, this is complicated. But it was the only section where I was kind of brought out of the story. And I was like, yikes, this is... it's so easy to take for granted the times that we're in right now, but this was a pretty bold book when it was being written.
Yeah, I kept thinking about the time in which this was written also.
Well, and based on her biography, she didn't give two shits. She was like, I'm writing what I'm writing.
Yeah, yeah.
Take it or leave it. Within that section, too, just the whole character reminds me of, like, this is a little autobiographical because she just seems like she doesn't care. And she's offended, but she's like... I don't get it. And I think she's kind of more comfortable with who she is, and she's got a bigger plan, a bigger reason for being. And this is just kind of...
It's like a good breaking point for her character where she goes...
She can be all in now.
Okay. Well, but she isn't. It seems like this is the point for her to be all in, but she gets stuck still. And I think that's really relevant too. And I think that's the point that Jodi Scott's trying to make, is that we all get stuck again and again and again as we're trying to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a good breaking point, and this is where she decides to follow Ben Arroyo's lead.
Yeah, I want to make one real quick note is after she gets fired, she goes to her office and is packing up and she's really pissed off.
Mm-hmm.
But there's this scene where she says she's grabbing all her stuff and she grabs, quote, her desk bottle of Jack Daniels.
Oh,
yeah. I was like, man, what a great time.
I see that, yeah.
Also, we find out that the sperm operation has been totally ruined. Like, gone downhill.
Yeah, they hadn't thought of any laws.
And the law came down on them hard and was like, you can't do
it. Was like they made $11 million and the law was like, wait.
Yeah, yeah. They took everything and that all fell apart. But we get to the big ending now where they have now found the Sojourian hideout, like the real one. And we find out it's at the bottom of Lake Michigan. It's like an entire city underneath Lake Michigan.
Yeah, and they think that's where Blake and Vicky are being held.
And Oblivion and Ben Arroyo are going to voluntarily dive down.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where Ben Arroyo's character shifts dramatically for me. I don't know if she did for you. She gets crazy. It's like bloodthirsty. She's like, we're going to kill everybody, including all the children.
And
it's going to
like,
be so much fun.
She keeps calling it a game.
It's a game, yeah. And
because death isn't real. But then they're shooting them, freezing them with the H2 unit into their bodies and killing them. So it's not a game.
It's like a slaughter, though. And Virginia gets really weird.
No, not Virginia.
No, she gets really weird. And then Oblivion is like, I can't be a part of this. And
but they're in wetsuits swimming underwater into Lake Michigan.
It gets crazy. I have a section. You have the book in your hand. Do you want to read? There's the bottom of page 179.
Okay.
Is what I have quoted when I was like, whoa, this character went from being like goofy and fun to way more complex and crazy.
So like the last chapter?
The last little section.
Or the last paragraph?
Yeah.
Now for a good cleansing romp of butchery patterned after Vietnam, so we can set fire to huts with kids in them and hack heads off and all of that. You're going to love it. If we get separated, remember, it's only a game like everything else.
That's dark. Like, that's really dark. They're swimming down to the bottom of Lake Michigan to go slaughter...
mermaids.
A bunch of mermaids, yeah, that have... Mm-hmm. Are living in the Palace of Neptune recreation, in case you missed that. Okay.
Yep.
Oblivion is definitely not into the killing, but they're down there, and it starts, and it's all chaos, and a slaughter happens. They end up defeating them, but in the process, Oblivion is hit. And she's hit pretty bad. And she starts to question everything.
And she's dying.
Yeah, and she's like, I think Wolf is evil, and I can't stand for any of this. And this is the big twist, is she turns the gun on Virginia Woolf.
And this is a flashback, though.
Yeah, this is what she was talking about in the beginning. And she shoots her. Mm-hmm. And then after she shoots her, she takes off her own mask and kills herself at the bottom of Lake Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
Then we get to chapter 26.
But hold on. We remember the beginning when Virginia Woolf says that she's immune to this H2 unit. She cannot be trapped in her own body. So we know it doesn't work.
But we do know that
Sterling can die.
Sterling took off her mask and basically drowned herself. Yeah. Then we get to chapter 26, wake up in a hospital.
Oh, yeah. This is a
very frustrating chapter.
Yes. So Sterling wakes up in a hospital. Her husband, Johnny File, a balding, middle-aged, like, loser poet, is there.
The nurse is Patsy.
And so
she had a hemorrhage and almost died.
Yes.
And it's a Wizard of Oz moment again.
Yeah.
Where she's like, and you were there, and you were there.
Yeah.
And I had this dream where I was like hopping the universe in bodies.
As an alien.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, no, this is not how the book's ending. And then we get Wolf's
voice. Hold on. So she's describing her husband, Johnny. And I love this line. So in this weird chapter where she wakes up from this near hemorrhage, she says, Johnny was dozing right now, slouched in a chair across the room. He was a bore, but what dead person isn't? I love that. Oh, I thought, yeah, so true. All dead people are boring. But also, yes.
And then that all comes to an end because Wolf calls out, it's a drill. And boom, we're into the last section.
Yes,
which
we
is
are.
Wolf tells Oblivion she'll teach her how to create her own reality.
Yes.
And it wasn't as easy as she thought it would be to die. And they get Vicky and Blake back in exchange for the leader of the resistance, the Scalzo.
Yeah.
And then it is the most appropriate ending for this book I could think of, because it just shifts. And I loved this ending, by the way.
It was bananas, Foster. So we go to ancient Egypt, obviously.
Oh, yeah. That's where we're at now.
Obviously. So they've gone to ancient Egypt.
And Blake is a master designer of the pyramids, which is going to be passed down through the Romans and everything else. Vicky is a priestess in the Temple of Ra in Marilyn Monroe's body. And Oblivion and Wolf now live in a hut with two dogs, three cats, and nine ducks.
Yes. And so they're all building the pyramids using, like, telepathy or telekinesis or something. This is a great line at the end. So Wolf insists, we're going to have barrels of fun and peace of mind because you decide to have peace of mind, and that's all there is to it.
There you go. That's that. That is
so, yeah.
I Vampire. Who knew that that's what we were getting into?
Yeah, I thought it was going to be like a real cheesy trash novel. And it was something where I didn't realize that this author had a real perspective and were making very interesting points. And it actually kind of falls in line with other stuff I've been reading at this time. It's really about, like, creating your own reality. And it's pretty beautiful.
It is beautiful. At the end of it all, it started off fun. Then it got goofy. And I was like,
pretty
crazy. This is fun. But by the end, especially after explaining it tonight, which is going to sound bonkers to our listeners.
No, but it made
so much sense now. Like, reviewing it in my mind, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's a pretty clear novel. I get it. I get what was happening. I get the overarching theme for the most part. I think there's a lot that could be found in it.
It's about love.
Yeah, analyze it a little bit more.
And creating your own reality.
Yeah, but man, what a treat that book was.
I read that there was a third book written, but they didn't release it in the 1980s, even though she wrote it in the 80s, because they didn't think it would fit in. And it was released, in the 2000s, yeah. I believe, after her death.
Well, and there was a lot of like legal battles too, and so but it's been released now, so there's, yeah. It's a trilogy.
I'm definitely going to read the other two. When we grabbed this from a thrift store, or when you did, we didn't know it was a part of a trilogy, so we just decided to read it. But now I want to read the rest of it and like put it together and see Jodi Scott's vision from beginning to end.
And in the first book, Passing as Human, I think is what it's called, is Ben Arroyo is the main character, and Sterling Oblivion's like a bit part. And so it's really interesting. It'll be very interesting to see how this all pans. Maybe we can do it for a future episode.
Perhaps, yeah.
I think that, I mean, we'll classic see how to this do plays part out. Two first and then do part one.
Yeah. And then part three.
Zero downloads on this episode. We'll be like, well, maybe we won't do it.
It feels pretty crazy, but.
I think it's good. This is a great book. This is the test.
If we're testing?
We're testing our listeners right now.
Oh my gosh.
If you're into this episode, you're into what Laser Graves is about.
If you're into this, blink three times.
Oh, that was a lot of blinks.
So many blinks.
That was rapid fire. So if you like what you hear, please rate, review, subscribe. We're on iTunes. We're on
Spotify. Please share. It really helps us.
We're on all that stuff. We're also on Instagram at Laser Graves. I'm on Instagram at EK Wimmer. You're on Instagram
at Mariah Rose Wimmer.
And so track us down or follow us, but please subscribe, and we'll give you a break because this week was so intense.
It was a little dense.
We are going to give everybody a prize next week by going mainstream.
What are we doing next week?
Return to Oz.
This was fascinating, and it's something that people haven't heard about. And they're going to go, we relate so deeply that we're going to subscribe. We're going to recommend it to 5 friends. We're going to give a 5-star review, and we're going to listen to Return to Oz.
That's right. People are going to say, we go to Laser Graves to get the real deal. We got I Vampire on Laser Graves.
They
we didn't get back
about
to the
it
future.
In their closet.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's it, everybody. We'll see you next week. I think I'm done.
I want to keep going.
Okay. Bye.